Thank you. It's really great to have the opportunity to come into down to Toronto and the Fields Institute in particular, and talk about some of the stuff I've been doing over the past few years, and along with students and colleagues, as you see listed there. One topic I've been looking at quite a bit is the idea of having data, fine, in a small amount of space. Sounds like data compression. But what I'm primarily interested here is encoding sort of the structural information that you're likely to have in a database system. References, to links, indices, all that kind of stuff, trees. So what it boils down to a large extent, is large combinatorial objects, some sort or other, and probably even static objects. We're probably not even too concerned with doing updates, and I'd like to represent them as succinctly, in a small amount of space as I can. But unlike standard data compression, what I want to do is operate on these combinatorial objects directly. If I've got a tree, I want to know a directed tree. I want to know its children. I want to know its parent. I want to know how big its subtree is. That sort of information. So the set of operations can be fairly rich, and I would like to be able to do that do these basic things in sort of constant time. So an example to start with that is another simple combinatorial object is that I've got a number of elements, let's say m elements, from the integers 0 through n, or 1 through n. And 1 through n for the mathematicians, 0 through n minus 1 for the computer scientists, who count differently. So what I would like to do is, obviously I could represent a simple bit factor, and I want to say what elements are in and what aren't. I want to create this static structure, and my model of computation is that I have a big long string of bits, and in one operation I can look at not just one, but log n consecutive bits. That's the word. So if I make that my model, then I say, okay, it's fairly flexible, it's fairly realistic, in terms of reflecting of indirect addressing, picking up an object, picking up an address, and say, I'll look in that location. So let's take a look at how much space I need for that. Well, obviously, if approximately half of the elements are in my set and approximately half aren't, then a bit vector is it, done, quit, go home, and that was a short talk. Suppose in this case the number of elements in the set is relatively small, but not ridiculously small, then the simple observation is that there are n choose m possible subsets I could have to represent, and so the log of, if I know the size of the universe, I know the size of the set, then the log of n choose m is an information theoretic lower bound on how much space I would need. So that's fairly natural for the lower bound on space, so I want to get away with that much, and maybe a little bit more space, and I would like to do, let's say, member queries, just is an element in or not in constant time. Now, if m is large, use bit vectors, but life gets rather interesting in the range where m is n divided by, let's say, the log of n. That range, life gets fairly hard in this kind of structure, and that could be reduced quite substantially the amount of space you would need. It could make the difference between an object fitting in memory and it not. That's a sort of one example of things, but what I'm going to do mostly today to get the feeling of the general topic is to look at representing trees, because as we all know, computer science is arbophilic. So we've got trees lying around all over the place, directories. When you're doing searches and indexing B-trees, the standard mechanism for holding for indexing large files is the B-tree, which is a tree of fairly high degree, but relatively fixed degree, and it's balance, so the root to the leaf path is fairly short. A lot of graph structures we do tree-based searches on. And another thing that is going to come up a few times here is that indexing for searching, indices for searching text, including DNA data, a natural thing to use is a tree-type index, where our query would be, does this string occur in my database? How many times does this string occur in my database? We'll see that as we move along. As we move along to the next slide. A starting point for motivation of why I was interested in this type of work came, quite a while, about 15 years ago, I guess, when we were working at Waterloo on a project to do with the Oxford English Dictionary and text search. And, in fact, one of the key players in that project, in terms of the software, was Blake. No, not this one. His wife. It was Betty Blake. Some of the problems, some of her ideas early on in implementation certainly influenced what I subsequently started looking at from a theoretical point of view. Okay, so here's the deal. You've got a large, long string of text. Let them be bits for now. And what I want to do is that I want to be able to tell whether a given string occurs in it. So I want to encode a billion or so character string and to see if to be or not to be, that is the happens to occur in that string. Now, anybody who's indexing that string is going to be thrown out all of the, by normal techniques, well, thrown out the stop words, like to, be, or, not. And so to be or not to be becomes the null string if you just index on non-stop words. So we're going to do, what we're doing here is, for this example, this motivating example, is that we're going to store the entire thing and then ask if a substring occurs. Clearly in genetic data, this is a very natural thing to do. So, to start, we're going to have a misspelling of tree. We pronounce it try. A digital tree. And so we start with the root, that's the null string, and then we're going to wander down this string, going left on a 0, going right on a 1. And when we get to a leaf, we're going to have a reference. And that reference is going to be to the unique, where it is, location in the string, in the data string, where that string occurred. So 0, 0, 1 points to this. And why is it unique? Well, it's because I'm going to go down until it is unique and then have the reference at that point. So I'll do that, and so I have a binary tree. It's got n leaves, all of the starting points in the string. And so all is fine and dandy, except for one little glitch, and is, what do I do if one of the internal nodes of the tree, you're at a point in the tree, so where you are tells the string from the start to your particular position. If all places in the string that are 0, 1, 1, 1, 0 happen to have the next character be a 0. So that would be a binary tree in which there is only one child of a given node. Ignore them. Quite literally, throw out those ones, skip the test at that node, and just put a little flag somehow and indicate the branching, that indicate that you are to skip the next few nodes. And then if you do that, you wind up with a nice, lovely binary tree in which every node is of degree 2. There are no nodes with just one child, n minus 1 internal nodes, n leaves. And you run down the thing following the bits as it goes, and then if you get to the bottom, you leap to the unique place where it occurs. Oh, and you better check that you're right, because you may have skipped a few of the bits along the way, and, gee, the string you're interested in may not have occurred at all, but you'll find that out. Oh, and by the way, if along the way you happen to type in the word "the" in some large document, then you go T-H-E, and oh, you're at the top of a great big subtree. Nice answer here is, how many times does the word "the" occur? Or how many times does a particular pattern occur? That's just subtree size from somewhere you are in that tree. So it's a reasonable application that, and reasonable approach. It's called a Patricia tree or a suffix try. But the standard representations are not very good. The standard representation for a binary tree, so that's a tree where it may have a left child and it may or may not have a right child. So what you're inclined to do is to say, what I want to do here is I want to go know who my left child is. I want to know who my right child is. I want to know how big my subtree is. I was concerned about that. And I want to know who my parent is, because I may be moving around the tree and need it for navigation purposes. And if I wander down that tree and I ran out of data and I'm asking the question, how big is my subtree? I can either store that explicitly, but I got a problem, and that is I've skipped some information on my way down. I have to confirm that. So I better know some leaf in my subtree. There's a bunch of junk I want to know, is what I'm trying to say. And there's PST and GST on top of that, which is what the standard system is going to take to allocate that hunk of space. And by the time you're done, you have taken, by my count here, six. Now let's assume that to refer to an object in a domain of size n takes you log n bits. I mean, that's how many it does to uniquely identify. So I get six n words, or taking a word to be log n bits, six n log n bits. Sorry, typo. I'll just take my pen out. Somehow I've never done that. I'm impressed. Okay, so this suffix tree then takes five or six times as much space as simply having the references to all of the places in the data stream indexed in order by what starts by their suffix, by what starts from them to the end, which, in fact, in practice, has been the standard way of indexing full text. And that is, you simply have a set of references to all places in the text in order, lexicographic order, by what follows the object from the given spot to the end. And that way you can do a search relatively quickly. But no, it's logarithmic time rather than constant. Okay. So that's some of the motivation. Now, the problem is, we'll go back here, and I'm taking 6 n log n, or 5 n log n, if we drop the leaf references, bits to represent this large combinatorial object. How many such combinatorial objects are there? Well, it's the nth Catalan number. There are exactly the nth Catalan number of binary trees. And the nth Catalan number, whoa, typo, sorry, 4 to the power n. Yeah, 4 to the power n divided by the, what's usually required in all these formulas. You have to have a pi and an n and a square root of at least one square root, and maybe a 3 halves is even classier. But the real point is that we have approximately 4 to the n of these combinatorial objects. And therefore, immediately, I can tell you which one I'm talking about in 2 n bits. Because this number is indeed, the log of this number is 2 n, take away a little bit. So, gosh, this is a substantial gap. In practice, let's say of a 4 billion character string, I would say that I need 8 billion bits by this calculation here, and by the previous calculation, I need, well, a couple of billion, I said, 2 billion is n, multiplied by log n, that's another 32 or so, and multiply by that other factor I had lying around of a 5 or 6 out in front, we're talking about a factor of 100 larger without any real troubles. So how do you go about attacking this? And this is sort of the starting point of what I'd say is something that I found sort of fun to work with. And this actually leads me, unfortunately, to some thoughts of my first ever class at University of Toronto as a graduate student back in the early 17th century when Al Lehman, who unfortunately had something else on right now but was here earlier this afternoon, said that he was interested in strings of balanced parentheses, strings with nothing in them. And that was my memory of my first class. And I thought that was sort of an unusual interest to have, but somehow I caught it. So we can represent, how do we represent a tree succinctly or tersely and in a reasonable manner, and then we'll worry about navigation. Well, you can write it as a balanced parenthesis expression. And the deal is very simple, that as you're going to go into a node and you're going to say, oh, left paren, I hit a node. And then you're going to do search all of its subtrees, let's say from left to right. And when you get done with that, you're going to come back up to the node at the top, or the node that I said you started with, and say right paren. So the ordering is left paren, I'm at a node. Now do all of my children, and then come back when you're done and say right paren. And so I've got away with 2 bits each, a bit being indicating the difference between a left paren and a right paren. There's another notation. The first one is standard stuff. The second notation I think is kind of neat, and it's, as far as I know, due to Jacobson. A standard data structure in computer science is a thing called a heap, as a perfectly balanced binary tree, in the sense that the distance from the root to all leaves is the same, all internal nodes have degree 2, and the only thing is we want it to work for all values of n, so the leaf's distance from the leaves is either k or k plus 1, because n is not 1 less than a power of 2. And so what you do is you simply take all of the leaves on the lower level that you're stuck with and shove them over to the left, and so it looks like this, across here, and whoops, at some point it has to have an off by 1 discrepancy. And in that notation, there's a very slick way of numbering the nodes, and that is to start with the root as being 1, and then having the left child be node 2, and then for the general case for I, the left child is 2i, and the right child is 2i plus 1, and away you go. And so you can navigate from parent to child. I'll come back to that in a minute. In the more general tree, Jacobson came up with an idea of doing the same thing, which sounds like it shouldn't work. And what we'll do is we'll take a completely arbitrary tree here, no binary tree, no constraints on it whatsoever. It's the black thing. And now what I'm going to do is to tack on external nodes or leaves absolutely everywhere. And so if there are n internal nodes, if there are n nodes in my tree to start with, fine. Add on n plus 1 leaves. Go on the outside. That's the blue guys. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to read that thing off in a sort of a heap-like manner. I'm going to write down a 1 for the old nodes of the real tree I had, and I'm going to write down a 0 for the new ones I added. So some are useful and some are originals and some are new guys. Fine. And then what I'm going to do to represent my tree is I'm simply going to read those bits, left to right, top to bottom. So that is a 1, 1, 1, as we see, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Oh, there's a 0, because that element's one of those artificial guys, just add on. There's a 1, 1, etc. And there we have a bit string of length 2n plus 1 that tells you what binary tree with n nodes I'm dealing with. I got away with 2n plus 1 bits, and I understand what the thing is saying rather than some rather complex code that tries to do what? 2n minus the log of n or so, which the information theoretic bound would give. So let's talk about that representation. And now bounce back to my comment about the heaps, the perfectly balanced tree where everything is in the right place and totally full until it just plain stops. In that case, there's an ordering that says to go to your child, ooh, parent to child mapping. Double for your left child. Left. Left is that way, isn't it? Yeah. After the medical application of mathematics talk, I should have thought of my friends who are radiologists who have learned to say left and right. It's a trick. Okay. So in the standard heap, you double to go to your left child, you double and add 1 to go to your right child. In this particular domain, you've got things a little bit more complicated. Clearly, the number of 1s up to a given to your point. 1s mean those are real nodes in the tree. They count. They matter. Ooh, up to your point. So that means above you anywhere, whether they're on your path or not, or to your left on your row. Okay. And the number of zeros before you are, well, the things that, I guess it's the number of ones, sorry, it's your position, take away the number of ones. They aren't quite as interesting. So it turns out that knowing how many ones there are up to your given position, including you, is useful. Gee, in the heap world, that would be your position. Here, it's a little less than your position if there have been some leaves ahead of you. And select is the inverse operation, which basically says, tell me where the ith one in this bit vector is. Ooh, we've got a bit vector we're talking about, and now we want some tough, awkward operations on it. But if you do that, you discover that the heap formula works. And that is to find out where your left child is, you say, how many ones are there up to and including me? And double that value. That is where we would read off your particular position. And if I wanted the right child, well, that's easy, you add 1. We saw that from the perfectly balanced case. And so if you want to go to the parent of a particular node, you're obviously going to have to take this piece of code and run it backwards. And so that means that you're going to double. Oh, so you're going to have to take a floor, yeah, because there was a double and a double plus 1. So take a floor, and then the opposite of the rank is the select. The opposite of telling me how many bits are on up to my point is to say, where is the such and such bit that happens to be on? So those are the kinds of things that we do. And so that gives a way, oh, that's interesting, that gives a way to write down a perfectly straightforward, arbitrary binary tree and go from parent to child. and also to have a number associated, a location, potentially, presumably in memory, associated with each node. So that could be kind of nice if we could figure out how to do this rank and select stuff. That looks kind of awkward. You're going to have a bit vector, and now you have to figure out where various things occur. And so this gets into some rather tight coding that I'll just hint at. It turns out can do this with a little bit of auxiliary storage. Oh, and it's one of the larger little bits. The original thing, let's say, is of length n to n or 2n, it really doesn't matter. Because if you count the tree as the n in the first place, fine. Or if you count then the vector will be of length 2n, so I can have my parameters being one either way. But I wind up with little o of n space. Asymptotically less than n. This is n divided by log n, so it's well under the n threshold, and then we multiply by a log-log term. So, okay, it's little o of n. And by having a bit of auxiliary structure that adds up to about that much space for the rank, how many ones are there up to my position? Well, every once in a while, you just say how many ones there are up to this particular position. When you play games, this is hard to pronounce, but every log n squared, so that is written as you pronounce it, bit, you give that. So if you want to find out the answer to a given point, you look up at the nearest spot that has the answer to its point. Now, between these two positions, they are only log n log squared bits apart. So in every few positions, approximately log-log positions in there, we write down the cumulative sum from the big marker as we go in, and then we can look things up fairly quickly. Sorry, every log n bit we do that, not log-log. So we play these games, and we can get that encoding fairly quickly. In fact, this code works very well. That's the rank. To do the select, where is the ith bit? Well, similar but substantially trickier, somewhat trickier games are played to be able to do that, to encode it so we can still do the match. And a key issue is that you're able to do the decoding, particularly the nasty select, by coming in. You look at a word of memory, log n bits. You then look at two or three other words. I'm not kidding. It's between three and four words total that you have to look at, each depending on the previous one, and you compute the rank and select process quite nicely. So a little observation: to play this game on a bit vector is kind of interesting all by itself. But to play it on a tree turns out to be very handy because of the previous encoding that we had. So by doing this, what we wind up with is having a way of encoding a binary tree in the minimum amount of space. I just tell you how big the tree is, and now I've got an encoding of that tree in virtually the smallest amount of space that you can possibly have. By that I mean the lead term in the minimal space you need, the log of the number of objects you've got, and then a lower order term. And I can enrich the set of things I've got there for operations. They don't have to be binary trees. They can be trees, free trees, let's say, trees in which they're rooted trees, and the children are ordered. You don't know how many children you've got, but they're ordered trees, ordinals, or they can be what we've been calling cardinal trees, which is a tree in which you've got, let's say, k slots for a child, like a binary tree, and each slot may or may not have an element in it. There are reasons why there are distinctions between your applications, between the ordinal and the cardinal there. So all these things can be done in pretty close to the information theoretic lower bound, and you can move around them fairly quickly. You can save factors of 30 to 100 on fairly standard representations, and of course that makes the difference between it being a major file on disk and it fitting nicely in main memory, and probably the part you really care about being in cache. There are extensions of this work that are very interesting, particularly by Liu et al., who've done similar things, taking this kind of work and representing particular classes of other classes of graphs, like planar graphs. There are whatever number of planar graphs, I forgot it off the top of my head, but basically a planar graph can be, there's a minimum, if you've got a graph on n nodes, there's a lower bound, there's a number of binary trees, or sorry, binary trees, planar graphs that there are. Using essentially that much space, you can represent your graph in that manner and navigate around it, all working quite nicely in main memory. Another topic that I've looked at recently is the idea of storing general functions. Let's say a function from the integers, 0 to n, to the integers. Represent that succinctly and carry out some interesting operations. Obviously, functions and permutations. Do permutations first. For permutations, you clearly want to compute the permutation. You clearly might want its inverse. Or you might want to, in some applications that we've encountered, you might want to go k steps forward in the permutation. So I'll say, I've got a permutation here. What is pi of i, k levels along, where k can be negative. So compute those sorts of things. Life is trickier with functions because stepping forward is perfectly well defined, perfectly straightforward. Stepping backward, of course, gives you a set, including potentially the null set. But we'll take a look at those in a minute. Take a little look at some work to do with permutations. The first part's not that exciting. And this is probably the most interesting open question. And that is, if I have a permutation, then I can write it down in a fairly straightforward manner. And let's suppose that this is a cycle of the permutation. I'll write down the permutation in the straightforward manner here, across the bottom, that 1 goes to 8, 2 goes to 4, 3 goes to 12, and you can believe me that if I don't have a typo, I've just written down the permutation in a straightforward manner across the bottom. So 4 goes to 5. What I have written in there is a cycle. Fine. Just an arbitrary cycle. I started it somewhere. I don't really care where. But I wrote the permutation in the black. And so if I want to go forward, if I'm at 2, I say the next position is 4. By this representation. And if I'm at 4 and I want to find out who came before me, I have a problem. So a boring way to handle this, if you had the cycle representation, is to be able to step back occasionally. Every once in a while, in the cycle representation, have a back pointer. Let's suppose you do that every tth location. And so that'll take you space, minimal space for the permutation, just write down the cycles. And then there's this back pointer stuff that will take, if it's every tth position, then every tth position has a back pointer, so plus a 1 over t term. 1 over t times the forward representation. Okay. There is a little bit of a problem that we have here. The problem is that if we write down the permutation in the straightforward manner, as we have here, some of these values, like 13, like 13, 13 is going to have a back pointer. It's going to have an extra piece of information associated with it. And 3 is going to have an extra piece of information associated with it. Life would be okay in the cycle representation, but in this other representation, it's mildly awkward. 1/10 of these values have an extra piece of information associated with them, but for all intents and purposes, they're in there at random. They're in there in some way that depends on the structure of the permutation, and I have no idea what that is. So that's mildly awkward. But what I'll do is I'll keep an additional bit vector and just flag the elements where I want back pointers. 1 bit per node. Flag the elements I want back pointers, and then I play my games with the rank and select, and I say, oh, do you have a back pointer? No. Okay, fine. Don't worry about it. And if I want to go one step back, I start where I am, I step forward and say, do you have a back pointer? Do you have a back pointer? Do you have a back pointer? Going so many forth, and finally I find somebody in my permutation with a back pointer. How do I do that? Because that element has a B in there, and then I say, okay, well, ooh, how many ones are ahead of you? How many other people have back pointers ahead of you in this structure? Why do I want to know that? Because I want to write down all the back pointers together. And if you're if you're element 100 with the 43rd back pointer, then I pick that information up and I say, oh, you've got back pointer number 43. So I look it up. Succinctly storing these back references nicely compacted into the right space. And so I can go forward by taking a natural forward step. I go backward by walking along until I find somebody with a back pointer, counting how many steps I've taken. Take a back step T from that position and continue on until I've taken T minus 1 forward steps. Some number forward, a big one back. This is baby step, giant step approach. Bunch of baby steps, a big giant step back, and T minus 1 baby steps total forward. And it all works, and time 1 plus 1 over T, because every teeth guy has this, N, that's the number of objects I've got, and unfortunately it's a, well, fact of life, it's a permutation. And so since it's a permutation, there are n factorial permutations. The information theoretic lower bound on how to tell you what permutation I'm talking about is the log of n factorial, and so it's n log n minus n log e, and noise. So it's n log n, essentially. And I don't like it. I've got an epsilon in there. I want a lower order term. Unfortunately, that's the way things are at the present time. So we have that way of moving along. And that gives things in constant time. I just want to make a very, very quick comment about succinctly representing permutations. And I'm not going to go through these sorts of things, so I want to represent a permutation so I can go forward in it and backward in it and have a succinct representation. N log n bits, no 1 plus epsilon. And as fast as possible, compute pi or pi inverse. Constant time given 1 plus epsilon space. There are things called Benesch networks, which basically is a crossbar type of thing, and you have two elements coming in, two elements going out, and either the elements go straight through for the identity permutation, or they cross for the swap to adjacent elements permutation. Well, that's the base case. And the general permutation can be put together by recursively putting a Banach network in the middle of, n minus 1, 2 to the n minus 1 objects, and then tacking on these extra, with n over 2 objects. Here's one on n over 2 objects, here's one on n over 2 objects, and then we put in a few gates at the beginning and at the end, a list of things at the beginning and a list of things at the end as we double the size. When you do this, it's an interesting structure. It takes the minimum amount of space, and unfortunately, the behavior is to make a forward and backward translation. This takes the log of n divided by the log of n time. Not the kind of stuff we would like, but an interesting open question. Minimal space, but a little bit slow. So I'm going to come back to the issue of trying to compute powers of a permutation using that forward and back representation that we've suggested. So we've got a structure that represents a permutation and its inverse without doubling the space. Ooh, not that great, but all right, that's our starting point. So let's consider a arbitrary permutation that I'm going to write down now by its cycles. Any old way you like. Write the cycles in any order. Start the cycles anywhere you like. So that's fine. And now, actually, if I wanted to do this, I'm going to write this down just as a list of the numbers, except I'm going to write in red for now the starting point of every cycle. Okay. Clearly, I'm going to play that game with my bit vector. I'm going to have an auxiliary bit vector and be able to tell where the cycles start. Now, let's ignore that. Let's just look at this list of numbers that I have written down there, and that's another permutation of very questionable relationship. Given that my original one was not exactly unique anyway. And what's interesting in this particular situation, observation, is that the inverse of this other permutation is simply the position containing the particular value. Quite naturally, this particular element 2 maps to location 6. So given location 6, you say, what is 6? Yeah. Given location 6, I say, what is the inverse of this permutation? The question is simply asking, oh, where does 6 occur? And that's my inverse. So we can represent this particular permutation and its inverse. And now, suppose I take the inverse of this, the inverse in this auxiliary permutation, I represent it in that way with the other auxiliary structure, so I can compute, I represent it and its inverse together with that abbreviated representation that we'd suggested before. So you've got the succinct representation of this of epsilon, this permutation. And what we will do is to compute we'll compute the inverse there, and what does that mean up here in the original structure? is, hold on. We can use that in there in order to get into the, in order to find where the object occurs. Our trick in this cycle representation of a permutation is to find the stupid number. If I want to find who follows 5 in this permutation, life is very easy. It's the guy right after 5. The hard part is to find 5. So I represent this thing, I just write this thing down and pretend that it is this auxiliary permutation in which I can find the inverse. So the first thing I do when I want to find who is 10 steps down the permutation from 5 is I say, where's 5? Go to this, find the inverse of 5 there, and it says, oh, it's that location right there. Now I have the inverse of 5. I say, oh, okay, 5 is in this cycle as designated by these auxiliary things. Okay, which is the one to my left? This guy right here. My cycle starts with 3. My cycle ends with the guy immediately before 4. Right before that number, I know where my cycle is, I know how big my cycle is, and therefore to figure out how to go 10 steps around it, it's just a little bit of modular arithmetic. Fairly, a little bit of care, but and definitely care in representations, but things work quite nicely with that. So that particular idea, it works well, and the space for representing a permutation is the information theoretic lower bound of n log n bits, one in front of it, times this annoying 1 plus epsilon term. And the cost to find something is essentially 1 over epsilon. This kind of relation is absolutely classic for time-space trade-off sorts of things in complexity theory. Now suppose I want to compute a function. I want to represent a function. Well, a function is just a hairy permutation. Somebody should have said that. In fact, a function, integers 1 to n, integers 1 to n, is that a function may have a number of, basically a function is going to, you may have 2 values that map to the same location in the function. Apply the function again, may map with somebody else, apply the function a number of times, you get to some point, and then you may have a cycle sitting in there. So any function is in fact going to be a set of cycles where each particular point on the cycle is a tree, and the structures all have the feature that in terms of the function, things are oriented towards the roots of the tree and then around the cycle. So that's going to be the structure we have. So if you know what the cycles, so you've got to represent this in a reasonable manner. We represent the cycles as I suggested. We have to represent the trees, the structure I can get very nicely. No problem at all. We've already discussed that, representing the structure of the trees nicely. Unfortunately, I left off the labels in my diagram. And every one of these points has a number written there over which I have no control. Yeah. There are essentially, well, there are not essentially, there are n to the n functions from integers to integers, and so my structure is going to be basically n log n bits. Ooh, and a nasty 1 plus epsilon that I couldn't fix because of the cycles. So we have a representation there. But then what are we doing? What we want to do if we, let's go back to try to compute. We have a tree here. You come along and lo and behold, you are told you are here. We want to apply the function I times to this point. What that means is walk up I steps in the tree. So as far as the tree is concerned, I say, what is my ancestor I levels up? Now, this is a nice mathematical statement of saying, how do you back up arbitrarily in HTML documents? And there are all sorts of web-related things that one can talk about in that context. But I think I'll leave it as the pure mathematical statement here. So what I have to be in constant time, able to bounce up eye levels in the tree. If I go overshoot, I'll get to the root. Let's suppose I take J steps. Now it's life is easy. I'm in my cycle. I just have to take, what is it, I minus J steps around the cycle. And, of course, that could be an arbitrary number of times around the cycle. So that one we can do. Oh, tree representation, cycle representation. Yeah, yeah, step up the tree. Ooh, make sure you can find arbitrary ancestor some number of distance above you without writing down too much, in a reasonable amount of space, and continue from there. So that one is to go up the tree and then run around the cycle a number of times. But of course, we have other technical difficulties. Suppose I want the function inverse, which can arise. Then what I'm doing is running around the cycle backwards, and at an arbitrary point, I shoot off down one of these tree branches. So if I'm here and I say, I want my third level ancestor, then it's 1, 2, 3, this guy. 1, 2, 3, this guy. 1, 2, 3, this guy. Or 1, 2, 3, that one. It's a set. And if I want my, that sounded somewhat okay. You just run down the thing and then back up the trees, run up the trees if you like. Let's suppose I wanted my fifth level ancestor from here. 1, and up here. 2, 3, no, nobody there. 1, 2, 3, there. 4, nobody, oh, nobody else there, too bad. Nobody else there, too bad. There wasn't a fifth level ancestor up this tree, and I spent quite a bit of time looking up there. There's a lot of stuff that turns out not to be present. So that's a problem. And clearly that occurs at each particular spot that I have. Each particular branch spot throws out the potential for this difficulty. So going backwards is a lot harder than going forward. Fortunately, we are able to adapt a technique for level ancestors in trees to work in this manner, and we wind up with order n extra bits. Ooh, that's okay. Representing the function took me n log n bits anyway. Then there's this combinatorial structure I use in my representation that I can do quite succinctly. And that was the forward one. Going backwards, what I have to do, I have this awkward problem of where answers may or may not be. And so then there is a matter of the appropriate representation whereby what I can do is pick up all of the answers without paying for the dead spots, without paying for all the places where there weren't answers. And so the actual amount of time to, let's say we're going this way, the third order ancestors of this guy are these, seven nodes that we have marked here. What we can do is have structures associated with these trees and the permutation that don't take much space, they're quite succinct, and allow us in constant time just to rattle off all of the answers without any more work. You don't have to worry about the fact that there may be a little subtree lying here with one child, and therefore no appropriate ancestor, or maybe here with no appropriate ancestor. The runtime is order one. Yeah, you got to do something if there is no ancestor of a given sort, particularly if it's one of these guys that has no such ancestor, moving back up the tree, plus the number of answers that you actually have. And so this kind of theory can be developed in this manner for such succinct representations of arbitrary functions. So, when we're all done, as I suggested, with a representation that's, 1 plus epsilon times n log n bits, we can compute the function iterated k times in constant time, independent of the size of the function or of the number of iterations you want. And we can also compute the inverse iterated k times in order 1 plus size of answer. I'm saying I want to produce the answer, not just say how big it is, but therefore if I have to produce the answer, then one time step I say each value in the answer. So I think this has certainly been an interesting aspect of what one might have thought of time-space trade-offs in terms of representing things. Interesting combinatorial objects, trees were the natural, and recently we thought, let's take a look at permutations and functions, and they can be represented in order the lower bound, and maybe it ought to be exactly what the lower bound is. I had a 1 plus epsilon in one of my cases, in lower bound plus a lower order term. My typical answers were order n, or 2n for trees, plus n over log n or so, or for some of the other function things, an admitted 1 plus epsilon n log n, plus a lower order term. And the natural queries working constant time. And I think that there's some potential to further develop these things. We've done some implementations, and things tend to run fairly quickly. Setting up the structures is not too slow if everything fits in main memory, but it gets very nasty when things don't fit in main memory and you're bringing things in and moving them out. And so you're fighting that battle once to really make your combinatorial structure, let's say, of the order of 1/50th the size, if you're lucky, or maybe 1/30th the size. And this can make the difference of actually using whether it is feasible to use the tree structure or the actual full-blown combinatorial structure with all its natural operations in your computer application, as opposed to what is often done, or is generally done, in terms of text search, which is that people tend not to use that nice tree structure, which allows you to find how many times and where a string occurs, just by reading off the string down to a magic point and then checking that your answer is correct. And it hands you an answer of a treeful of answers, of a tree, a subtree that contains where your answers happen to be. It tells you how many there are much more quickly than the other sorts of searches. Another issue is a continuing issue is that initial slide I had about so-called suffix trees. We have at the bottom of a tree a bunch of pointers. And they point to positions that say, oh, the string that you get to here occurs in such and such a position. So the 0000 string, there happens to be a string of 10 zeros. That's the longest zero string there is in the entire thing, let's pretend. And it occurs in position 8,000. So we would say at the bottom of that leftmost position, we say where the most zeros occur. And then beside it, we have the lexicographically next least substring. That's permutation. But it's a very special permutation. You don't need n log n bits to say what that permutation is. And the reason is you could plunk down the initial string that I gave you as data in the first place, and that effectively tells you the permutation. It could be figured out from that point. So how do you represent that permutation in a much more natural way? Still succinct, but still having the feature that you can do searches on it quite quickly. I think that's a good place to stop.